All right, we're getting started off here with Europe and Eurasia, looking at the Russo-Ukrainian war. Ukrainian infantry and Kherson Oblast have begun crossing the Dnieper River into Russian-controlled land. Actually, I should say they again crossed the Dnieper River. There have been crossings before in the past. They were able to establish a beachhead, and according to a Russian official in Zaporizhia Oblast, they were able to cut Russian lines from Oleshki to Kimbern Split. Russian military bloggers claim that 1 to 2 companies of Ukrainian infantry were decimated by Russian artillery near Krynki, likely from the 177th Naval Infantry Brigade. The spokesperson for Ukrainian Command South says that Ukrainian troops have advanced 8 kilometers east of their beachhead. All claims should be taken with a grain of salt. All we know for sure right now is that Ukraine appears to have established a beachhead in the area and have made some gains. There is heavy fighting going on, and we'll probably know more in the future. Looking at Finland, Finland will either completely close or restrict to one crossing its border with Russia. Finnish authorities have seen a sharp increase in particularly Iraqi and Somali migrants trying to cross from Russia into Finland with little intervention from Russia's border services. Finland has also accused Russia of transporting these migrants to the border. Russia responded by saying that Finland was, quote, destroying bilateral relations and, quote, choosing to confront Russia. Estonia may also follow suit, as they have reported 27 foreign nationals from November 10th to the 13th being caught trying to cross into the country from Russia. This includes 17 Somalis and 7 Syrians. This is reminiscent of Belarus guiding thousands of Afghan migrants to the Polish border in 2022, which caused a very tense standoff between the two countries. Moving on to the Indo-Pacific region, looking at Japan, on the 15th, a man drove his van into the gates of the Israeli embassy in Tokyo. A police officer was injured in that incident and the suspect was arrested. The driver failed to penetrate the protective barriers of the embassy complex, and we don't know a whole lot more other than that. They said that the suspect was part of some right-wing group, but I haven't really been able to find any details on that. So I'll keep you guys up to date if I find anything else on that, but that's pretty much where things lie right now. Moving on to the Middle East, Osama bin Laden's letter to America went viral on TikTok over the week, interestingly enough. This was a letter that bin Laden wrote in 2002 trying to justify the 9/11 attacks by critiquing the United States for a multitude of things. This includes its support of Israel. The letter also criticizes fornication, homosexuality, and intoxicants. Again, it covers a lot. Videos on TikTok supporting bin Laden's letter were shared widely in the broader context of the Israel-Hamas war. Pro-Palestine users that posted videos supporting bin Laden urged their viewers to read the letter and share its message. On Tuesday and Wednesday, 274 TikToks about the letter garnered 1.8 million views, which isn't really viral considering that videos about skincare get over 250 million views a day. But after the trend was discussed on Twitter, views on TikTok shot up to over 30 million. Additionally, The Guardian had an article with a letter up from 2002, the entire letter, and they hid that article because of the trend. When they did that, some supporters started viewing the letter as forbidden knowledge, and that further drove this trend of people wanting to see what it was all about, pretty much. But TikTok is heavily suppressing videos that have any mention of Osama's letter. Instagram is doing the same. A lot of social media companies are doing the same. So that trend is kind of dying down right now, as people don't really have access to it, at least not from what I could tell. Moving on to the Israel-Hamas war, Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid is calling for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign from office in order to form a national reconstruction government. Lapid says that there should be a new governing coalition with Netanyahu's Likud party at the head, actually, just without him. This call comes at a time when Netanyahu is losing popularity. A majority of Israelis say that he is at least somewhat responsible for the October 7th attack, and Likud's support in the polls has been taking a nosedive since the war began. In fact, if the elections were held right now, they would not do too great. Likud responded by saying that Lapid is playing politics during a time of war and that replacing Netanyahu would lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state. Moving on to reported casualties. Again, these are reported casualties, right? So could be higher, could be lower. Who knows? Looking at Gaza, you have 11,250 people killed, 28,200 injured. Looking at Israel, you have 1,200 killed and 7,266 injured. So that number was recently revised down a bit by probably about 250. Israel says that issues with identifying bodies and the fact that some Hamas gunmen on October 7th were actually dressed in Israeli military uniforms added to this discrepancy. As for civilians, 859 are confirmed to have been killed. The vast majority of those were killed in the October 7th attack. The IDF has taken 56 killed in action and 260 wounded in the Gaza operation. I haven't been able to find a good number for those wounded. The most recent I could find was at 260, and that was dated November 3rd. Obviously, many more soldiers since then have been wounded. I just can't really find a good number. Moving on to the West Bank, 204 people have been killed. The vast majority of those are Palestinians. 2,486 have been injured. In Lebanon, 94 have been killed. This includes 74 members of Hezbollah. In Syria, 26 have been killed, 15 have been wounded, and in Egypt, 9 have been wounded. This gives us a total of 12,778 killed and 37,976 wounded. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has made some clarifying remarks regarding the war. The war on Hamas doesn't just apply to militants in the Gaza Strip, according to him. It applies to anybody under the Hamas banner. This is regardless of what country they're in, and even if they, quote, wear a three-piece suit, as he puts it. There is some disagreement over what should be done to Gaza if and when the war ends and if Hamas is defeated. As we have previously reported, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu plans to place the Gaza Strip under the administration of the Israeli military. The Biden administration is not really big on this idea. Instead, Biden says that a renewed Palestinian Authority should eventually control the Gaza Strip after Hamas is defeated. Obviously, probably a long way to go for any of that to happen. So just kind of giving you guys an update on where things stand. That's pretty much it. The push into the western portion of Gaza City is still ongoing. The coastal axes from the south near Wadi Gaza and the north have linked up to form one front. Additionally, IDF troops have captured most of Beit Hanun, and some forces are breaking off to move south of that city. Since last week, the major focus of the operation has been Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. The IDF claims that the hospital holds a major Hamas command post underground and was thus a major objective towards securing northern Gaza. The U.S. government has recently come out and said that their intelligence agencies assessed the same, that the hospital has been used by Hamas for command and control and weapons storage purposes. The IDF also accuses Hamas of using the hospital, particularly its ambulances, to transport fighters, and also using the hospital to hide from Israeli airstrikes. We saw the ambulance allegations when an Israeli airstrike hit an ambulance convoy, leaving the hospital for the Egyptian border a couple weeks ago. Israel claimed that those ambulances were transporting Hamas fighters, and that strike killed 15 people, including women and children. And we still have no indication that that was indeed transporting Hamas fighters at the time. The hospital was not fully evacuated ahead of the Israeli assault on it. Doctors said that it was not possible to evacuate critically injured patients, children among them. Additionally, the hospital was running very low on fuel for its generators due to the Israeli blockade for fuel, and an Israeli airstrike destroyed the solar panels on the roof of the main building. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said that Israel offered to provide the hospital with food and also evacuate children, but Hamas refused. Geolocated footage does show Israeli soldiers carrying fuel, incubators, and other forms of aid in the vicinity of the hospital. The operation to seize Al-Shifa began early on the 15th. At the time, according to the World Health Organization, there were around 600 to 650 patients, 200 to 500 healthcare workers, and about 1,500 internally displaced persons. These are Gazans that left their homes. Fighting did occur during the operation. Israel has been releasing photos and videos from the complex since it has been captured. For the, quote, beating heart of Hamas, the visual evidence is pretty lacking so far. Photos show mostly AK pattern rifles, magazines, grenades, body armor, uniforms, and documents. Again, fighting did go on during that assault. A tour through the hospital's MRI compound showed only weapons, body armor, and laptops. No tunnels or command posts were shown in that video. Additionally, Trey Yingst of Fox News reported from Al-Shifa, and he says that he was not shown any tunnels either. Additionally, he was also not allowed to speak to any of the patients or healthcare workers. He was only allowed to speak to who the Israeli military allowed him to, which is typically their personnel. The IDF released videos showing the entrance to two holes leading underground on the northern perimeter of the hospital. It isn't clear if they're tunnels, rooms, something else. As of right now, we have not seen a vast tunnel network the IDF claims is under the hospital, and we have also not seen a major Hamas command post either. The Israeli military says it will take time to gather evidence. They're still going through the tunnel complex, so we'll be standing by for more information on that. As of right now, 291 patients and 25 healthcare workers are still in the hospital. That's according to the UN. Plans are currently being made for their evacuation. Moving on, the UN Security Council on Wednesday voted to call for an immediate multiple-day-long ceasefire to get aid to civilians and allow them to evacuate to the south. That motion passed 12-0 with the U.S., Russia, and the U.K. abstaining. Of course, the motion is not enforceable, though, and a ceasefire is not expected. The Houthis are still launching munitions at southern Israel, particularly the city of Eilat. Over the week, the U.S. destroyer USS Thomas Hudner engaged and shot down a drone that was fired by the Houthis in Yemen and was likely aiming for Israel. No crew was harmed in that incident. Border clashes between Israel and Lebanese Hezbollah have continued. Not really much to report on that front, more the same. Roughly 239 others are still being held hostage in Gaza. So far, only four hostages have been released. This includes two Americans with dual citizenship. I've removed two from the overall count as Yehudi Twice, a 65-year-old grandmother, was found dead inside a building near the Shifa Hospital complex. Weiss was a resident of Kibbutz Beeri when she was kidnapped on October 7th. That community was the site of one of the worst massacres during the attack. Hamas terrorists killed more than 120 people, including women and children, and Weiss's husband as well. And then additionally, Corporal Noah Marciano, who was kidnapped on the 7th as well, was found dead in a building also near Al-Shifa Hospital. And that's why I've removed those two from the count. So that's pretty much where we are as far as hostages go. There's reporting that Israel and Hamas are close to a deal where Hamas will release hostages in exchange for a ceasefire. People have been talking about that for weeks. Nothing's happened yet, so I'll be standing by. I'm taking it with a grain of salt, personally. On the 18th, an explosion hit the Al-Fakura School, which is run by the UNRWA. That is a UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East. The explosion was allegedly caused by an Israeli airstrike. The school is inside the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, which was hit by multiple airstrikes on the 18th. And it has also been hit by strikes before in the past. Hundreds of Palestinians were taking shelter in the school when the explosion happened. The Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas, says that 80 people were killed by airstrikes inside Jabalia today on the 18th. Videos posted from the school do show the bodies of at least 30 people who are either dead or severely injured at the time. This includes women and children. The UN claims that 200 people were killed or injured in that explosion at the school. The Israeli government says it is investigating the incident, but as far as we know, that's pretty much it for now as far as what Israel's response to those accusations have been. Since October 17th, there have been at least 60 drone and rocket attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria. The Pentagon has confirmed 56 casualties so far. This includes 25 traumatic brain injuries. Thankfully, all 56 people have since returned to duty. The U.S. military has launched three response strikes. That third response was about a week ago, and there have been attacks since then. All right, we have an update on Allied Naval Forces posture. Thank you to Ian Ellis and Intel Schizo on Twitter for their infographics. The Israeli Navy has three corvettes and one missile boat operating south of Cyprus. The USS Forward Carrier Strike Group is west of Cyprus. The Dwight D. Eisenhower Carrier Strike Group is currently in the Gulf of Oman. The Bataan Amphibious Readiness Group is in the Red Sea, and it will remain there for the time being. The French helicopter carrier FS Tonnerre, as well as two accompanying French ships, are currently south of Cyprus as well. The British Littoral Response Group South, also near Cyprus. NATO Standing Group 2 is currently in the Sea of Crete. It's been there for a bit. And the UN Interim Force in Lebanon has a maritime task force. They are currently in the Eastern Med. That has about 5 ships. Dutch patrol vessel HNLMS Holland has been deployed to the Eastern Mediterranean to help with humanitarian relief. Italy has just deployed ITS Volcano, a logistics support ship, to the Eastern Med, and that will assist with humanitarian aid. I believe it will serve as a hospital ship. And there are at least 15 other ships in the region, including U.S. ships, that are not currently assigned to a task force or assigned to a mission tied to the situation in Gaza. Also, we have an update on that helicopter crash that happened last week. The U.S. Army has identified the 5 soldiers that were killed in a Black Hawk helicopter crash off the coast of Cyprus. All 5 soldiers were assigned to the Night Stalkers. That's the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. They are Chief Warrant Officer 3 Stephen R. Dwyer, 38, of Clarksville, Tennessee. Chief Warrant Officer 2 Shane M. Barnes, 34, of Sacramento, California. Staff Sergeant Tanner W. Grone, 26, of Gorham, New Hampshire. Sergeant Andrew P. Southard, 27th, of Apache Junction, Arizona. And Sergeant Cade M. Wolf, 24, of Mankato, Minnesota. And we will be praying for their families, of course, in this tough time they're no doubt going through. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. All right, we're back with the America's Bulletin from the Borderlands, released on the 15th. We covered a tense border and water dispute between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and also the upcoming presidential election in Argentina. It's actually happening tomorrow, Sunday the 19th. Looking at Venezuela, Savoy Wright, an American citizen from California, was recently arrested in Venezuela. His family claims that he is being held for tens of thousands of dollars in ransom, and he has not been charged since his arrest on October 24th. The circumstances regarding the 38-year-old businessman's arrest are not clear, and he has not even been able to speak with a lawyer, according to his family. The arrest comes after the Biden administration eased some major sanctions against Venezuela's oil industry. The America's Desk covered this in Bulletin from the Borderlands a couple of issues ago. The easing of those sanctions was part of a deal, and in return, Venezuela would allow opposition candidates to take part in next year's presidential election, and the country would also release political prisoners, including unjustly imprisoned Americans. For some reason, the Biden administration gave Venezuela until the end of November to comply with the terms of this agreement. Officials say that they may reimpose sanctions if Venezuela decides not to comply by the end of the month. We'll keep you guys up to date with that. Moving on to the U.S., got a presidential race update. Polls averages from 538. Biden's approval is at 39. His disapproval is at 55. Both of those remain the same from last week. Trump's favorability is at 41. That remains the same. His unfavorability is at 54. That is down 1 point. Looking at the Democratic primary, Biden is at 69%. Marianne Williamson is at 8. And U.S. Representative Dean Phillips is at 5. Looking at the Republican primary, Trump is at 59%. That is up 3 points from last week. DeSantis is at 14, and Nikki Haley is at 9. DeSantis and Haley both remain the same from last week. Moving on, a suspect has been arrested in connection with the death of Paul Kessler, an elderly Jewish man that died due to blunt force trauma to the head during opposing pro-Palestine and pro-Israel rallies in Thousand Oaks, California. Loay Abdel Fattah Anaji was arrested by the Ventura County Sheriff's Office and has been charged with involuntary manslaughter. Moving on the 11th, I missed this last week, a fire that was started at a homeless encampment near downtown Los Angeles led to a section of the I-10 freeway being heavily damaged and closed. The I-10 is a major artery for travel and the supply chain for Southern California, especially Los Angeles. Authorities believe the fire was a case of arson. Vehicles, vehicle parts, and wooden pallets were stored under the freeway and contributed to the voracity of the fire. It took 160 firefighters 3 hours to put out the blaze. The original timeline to reopen the freeway was 3 to 5 weeks, but it has been moved up, and the freeway is actually set to reopen later this week. Moving on, the U.S. Senate has passed the Armenia Protection Act of 2023. If passed by the House and signed by the President, the bill will suspend all U.S. military aid to Azerbaijan for the next 2 years. This is due to Azerbaijan's seizure and ethnic cleansing of the remaining portion of Nagorno-Karabakh that was under control of ethnic Armenians up until about a couple months ago. This is also due to some signaling from Azerbaijan that it may attempt to militarily seize some of Armenia's territory, which we have covered on this podcast before. Technically, U.S. law already prohibits military aid to Azerbaijan under the 1992 Freedom Support Act. That prohibition came during Azerbaijan's blockade of Armenia during the First Nagorno-Karabakh War. Although in 2001, the Senate adopted an amendment that allowed the president to waiver that portion of the act to send aid to Azerbaijan, and that waiver has been used before in the past. Senator Gary Peters, who sponsored the bill and also led a delegation to Armenia during the evacuation of Artsakh, said that, quote, "We will send a strong message that America will enforce conditions we attach to military aid," end quote. On the 15th in Washington, D.C., a group of about 150 violent pro-Palestine protesters surrounded the headquarters of the Democratic National Convention, blocking all entrances and exits to the building. Capitol Police officers were eventually able to evacuate the building. U.S. House office buildings in the area were also locked down as a result of the demonstration. By the end, six officers received injuries from minor cuts, pepper spray, and being punched by protesters. Only one protester was arrested for assaulting an officer. Moving on, the APEC summit was held in San Francisco from the 15th to the 17th. That is the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. As many of you have probably already seen, the streets of San Francisco got cleaned up pretty nicely before the arrival of Chinese President Xi Jinping. Governor Gavin Newsom justified this obvious attempt to beautify the troubled city for the summit by saying that you usually clean up your house before you have visitors over. The summit includes 21 countries that are either in East Asia or have a Pacific coastline, including the U.S., China, Mexico, Russia, South Korea, and Australia. According to Chinese state media, during the summit, President Xi Jinping agreed to reestablish military communication with the United States. At this time, however, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General C.Q. Brown, says that he is not received a phone call from the Chinese military. President Xi and President Biden also discussed anti-drug cooperation and cooperation on climate change, among other things. Personally, I wouldn't expect any real change in either of those arenas, but I guess we'll see. And the last story we got for the week, the U.S. Army has been sending letters to soldiers that were discharged for refusing to take the COVID-19 vaccine. The Army is offering to correct discharge records. Most, if not all, of the soldiers that were kicked out for not getting the vaccine were given a discharge that was other than honorable. The letter indicates that the Army is also hoping the soldiers will apply to return to the service. The military in general has been going through a major recruiting crisis for the past 2 years. In both fiscal year 2022 and 23, only the Marine Corps and the Space Force met or exceeded their recruitment goals. The Army, Navy, and Air Force all missed their targets by a long shot. This year, the Navy missed its targets for active duty enlisted soldiers by over 7,400, and it also missed targets for officers and reservists. For the Army, the size of the active duty Army has shrunk from 485,000 in 2021 to 452,000 right now. This is the smallest active duty Army since 1940. In 2022, they missed their recruitment goal by 15,000 soldiers. This crisis has necessitated changes made to policy, including the removal of a policy that mandated recruits have a high school diploma or GED equivalent before they join. Although after a lot of backlash, that policy was quickly reinstated. Around 8,000 soldiers were kicked out for not getting the vaccine, which is a lot, even if you don't take the context of the recruiting crisis into account. The letters that were sent out have been verified to be legit by the Army as well. It is not common for the military to make such a reversal like this, especially not publicly, which some would argue is essentially an admission that the service made a mistake. But that's pretty much all I have for you guys. I want to thank you all for supporting this podcast. It means a lot to me. You could find this on your favorite apps, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen, we're there. You could find us on Twitter and Instagram, Analyze, Educate. That is all one word. We are also on Telegram, same name. Please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/analyzeeducate, Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/analyzeeducate or analyzeeducate.substack.com. Again, all those links are in the show notes below. Be sure to leave us a 5-star rating on the app you use to listen to this podcast. That helps us out a lot as well. And I will see you guys soon.